Savior, may I learn to love thee, walk the path that thou hast shown. Pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own.
Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Okay, this is Danny Parkinson. I'm back again with the next installation of Gay Mormon Stories. Today I am talking with Eric Lavelle. He is a BYU student just finishing up there. Eric, do you want to say hello and we'll get right into it?
Well, hello.
Eric, where are you from?
I grew up in Henderson, Nevada, just outside of Las Vegas.
Okay. So you're not too far from your original home.
No.
Anyway.
Pretty
out
close.
There in Utah. That's almost Utah.
Yeah.
That was part of the original state of Deseret, even
right.
though it got
exactly.
usurped by Nevada. Okay. Well, I just want to, you know, follow my normal format today and just start out by asking you about your Mormon background, your Mormon heritage, and, you know, what kind of family you came into.
Sure.
When you were born.
So on my dad's side, we've been members for forever, since Parley P. Pratt. I'm pretty sure he was the one who introduced my dad's side to the church.
So you're descended from Parley P. Pratt?
Not descendant. He baptized my dad's family, if that makes sense.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So we've been in the church since then. On my mom's side, my grandpa was a convert. He converted when my mom was around 8 years old. And his wife was always a member. So my mom kind of grew up with a part member family until she was 8. But my family is very religious, very Mormon. All I remember is my dad being a very charitable. He goes out and he takes home teaching to a new level. I mean, when we were companions, we would see our families twice a week or twice a month. And just we were very involved. And that's my memory of my dad in terms of church activity. And the same with my mom. So.
Okay, so these were very valiant Mormons, you might say, who magnified their callings,
right.
who wanted to go the extra mile, because hardly anybody home teaches more than once a month.
Right.
That's a pretty rare thing.
I think in my family, part of how we were raised was you didn't just accept a calling, but you made the calling your identity, and it kind of became who you were. So it was very much you lived up to what they asked you to do, and it wasn't. We rarely did anyone give a half-hearted effort when they got a calling. So that was just kind of how I was raised and what I saw from my parents.
Yeah. Well, so how about your childhood? Would you, you know, this is just my stereotypical questions about that I'm going to ask any gay person,
right.
but I'm going to ask you the stereotypical things. Did
sure.
you, were you a rough and tumble kid or a sensitive kid or, you know, would you say that there was things that made your parents wonder if you were gay at a young age? I mean,
that's an interesting question. Growing up, I was the fourth out of five, and I remember looking up to my brothers and sisters and thinking, how am I supposed to be different than everyone? Like, how am I supposed to have my thing? Because my brothers, older brothers and sisters were pretty involved in a lot of different activities. And so in my mindset, it was, I have to be involved in everything. So I was in music, I was in sports, I was in whatever I could get my hands on. So I don't even know if I fit any kind of stereotype, whether it was a sporty kid or a creative kid. I did everything growing
okay.
up. In terms of whether my parents guessed it, I don't think so. I remember when I told my parents, my dad said, well, maybe it's because you do so much music. You're a very sensitive child. So I don't know what that meant. But, I mean, I've always been pretty emotional. Like, I get pretty attached to people. But I wouldn't say that I was the typical sensitive, creative stereotype that a lot of people fix on homosexuals, but it wasn't like I was a masculine man either.
Okay.
So I was pretty varied in what I did in school and my activities and such.
Okay. And would you say that you were bullied as a young kid at all? Did you ever experience that, or was school just normal for you and church? And
well, there was one time that I've never forgot where I was. This one girl said that I was gay because I sat with my legs under my chair, with my ankles crossed. And apparently for her, that meant I was gay. And I was like, that was the only time anyone said anything like that. I've never really been bullied. I had a pretty strong group of friends that we were really close, and so we never really experienced much, and it was pretty calm most of my school.
Okay. And did you, I'm guessing there's lots of Mormons in Henderson.
Yeah. I think the statistic for my high school was 10 to 20% LDS. So we had to split up into two church buildings for seminary. So there was quite a few kids. There was enough that you could pick and choose your friends within the Mormon church, but there was also enough like outside of the group that you still had Mormon as an identity rather than everyone just being Mormon, if that makes sense.
Right. But was it, so there was enough that you had plenty of people to choose from for friends, but was it such that you tended to segregate with Mormons? I mean, that you tended to have most of your friends be Mormons and most of your social.
Right. I'd say my friends were about 50-50 Mormon and non-Mormon. Okay. Growing up.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to mention about your childhood before we move on to those troubling teen years that everybody has?
I don't know. It's pretty normal. I mean, my family was very close. It was very family centered. I remember until my last 2 years of high school, it was mostly I stayed at home on the weekends. I did activities with my family. So we were pretty family oriented. I think that's most of my life has been like that.
Okay. So how about then when you entered adolescence? This is a time that's almost universally difficult.
Right.
So how about for you?
I hated middle school. I remember, so when I was 11, that was I realized that I was interested in guys. And it's kind of been ever since I reached puberty, I knew that. It was never a question of, I never had this difficulty understanding am I gay or not? I just kind of always knew I was attracted to guys. I never put a label on it until later, but I knew that. And I was a very stressed child, I guess you could say, because I had this idea that in order, like I said, looking at my older brothers and sisters, I didn't get as much attention as everyone else. And so I tried my hardest to be the best at everything and to put myself out there and make a name for myself in whatever I started out. And so I was stressed because I had a lot on my plate. And I think that was what led me. I started viewing pornography, I think, when I was 11 or 12. And one of the reasons why, one of the examples of I knew I was gay immediately was a lot of people say that when they start looking at porn, or like studies say that a lot of gay people start out with straight porn and it slowly evolves to gay porn. But I remember when I looked at porn, at first it was just, I typed in the word porn just to see what it was. And then the second thing that I looked at was gay porn. And so it was never like this evolution. It was immediately I knew what I was attracted to.
Okay, but just a sec. So when you were 11 years old, you said you didn't adopt the label, but somehow you knew gay porn would give you images of men.
Right. I knew I was attracted to men, and but I never put that label on myself.
Uh-huh.
That was never I never needed to do that. I think it wasn't until after I got home from my mission that I actually had to think about what it meant for me, but I was never interested in dating or in being in any relationship with anyone, girl or male, when I was growing up, because I had so many other things that I was involved in. It just wasn't an idea.
Yeah. But I do kind of want to see if it's possible to dissect what you were conceptualizing then.
Right.
You say you knew you were attracted to men. Did you think about this as it'd be cool to kiss a guy? Did you think about it as, I'm interested in these pornographic images of men? Did you think about it, I just want to be with my best friend all the time? I mean, what can you kind of remember kind of what?
I think at the beginning it was mostly like the sexual release from the porn was. I mean, like I don't know how to say it when because it's all hindsight. I don't know what I was really interested in. I mean, I had both guy and girlfriends. I didn't have really a preference. So there wasn't really a relationship attachment need that I had really. And maybe it's because I had good male and female friends. I didn't feel like that was wanting. So it was, I would say probably it was sexual.
It was the porn basically.
Right.
And was this something that was creating a lot of guilt for you?
Yes. I mean, I had felt guilty about it ever since, like even up until my mission. The first time I confronted anyone about it, I went to my bishop and I told him, I think I was either 13 or 14. And his attitude was just like, oh, well, don't do it again. That's it. And I was like, oh, I wish it was that easy. Like I was like, okay, well, I'll try. And I mean, most of my life, every year I would go through this period where I was very hard on myself. And so I was like, for 2 or 3 months, I'd like, I'm never going to look at this again. Kind of working on it by myself. I think a lot of people go through. And then I'd just get so stressed out that I would just break and it would become even worse. So I had gone to my bishop on my own, but that was less than helpful.
But on the other hand, it wasn't particularly shaming. He seemed to...
Right, he kind of passed it off.
He obviously had a perspective that he probably had heard lots of young boys say this, young men say this, and wasn't really...
Right.
Didn't see it really helpful to make a big shaming thing out of it, a big event out of it.
Right. And maybe I had framed it in a way that I was trying to pass it off as if it wasn't something like it was a big deal. But he didn't seem too interested in trying to open the door to really solve the problem. He kind of just let it go. So that was an issue. So, I mean, but I was always guilty about it. And it was always in my thoughts. Like when I would go to seminary, I would sit there and they'd ask me to say the prayer. And my thoughts were, well, should I really say the prayer? Because I've been looking at porn last night or something like that. So it did follow me around a lot, but being so involved in orchestra or track or soccer, whatever it was, I was able to drive it from my mind for most of the time.
Did you have any conversations with peers to realize that sort of you weren't the only one?
I always felt that I was the only pervert. I mean, that, especially having so many Mormon friends, since it's such a taboo topic, no one talked about it. So it's pretty, I handled it mostly on my own until about high school. Last year, middle school, my mom found out and we talked about it and she actually noticed that it was homosexual porn. And she asked me, she's like, is there anything you want to tell me about that? And I told her, no, it's just, I was looking for anything that was there and that just happened to pop up kind of thing. I tried to pass it off as, oh, I was just curious or whatever. But again, I told her, I was like, I've talked to the bishop about it. We're working on it. And so again, it was just passed off as, okay, well, if you're working on it, let me know next time it happens, we'll work through it. But I kept on going and I just got better at hiding it. And then once I got into high school, I wouldn't get home from any activities until like 6 to 8 o'clock at night. And then I'd start my homework. And by then people were going to bed. So I was the only one up. So it was easy to look at porn in high school. And I remember, I think it was junior year, I talked to my parents about it. I went to them and I said, look, I have this problem. And this is when I started losing confidence in my parents to talk about things like this, because my dad took me aside and he's like, well, why don't we just leave you home at church so you can fulfill your little fantasies while we're not around? And that's how he handled it. And so I was like, oh, I guess I'm never coming to you to talk about anything like this again.
Was he being sarcastic?
No, he wanted to leave me at home because he felt, I don't have a worthy son. Why would he come to church if this is what he wants to do? Kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
And so I was like, well, okay, well, that's how my parents are going to treat it. I'm not going to talk to them about it anymore. But I still, after I told them, I went to my bishop again. And I was like, it was a new bishop at this time. And I told him, I was like, I have porn problems. And it was the same thing. It was just like, well, just stop doing it. Come to me in 2 weeks and let me know if you done it. And I mean, I had enough self-control that I could stop for 2 weeks. And so I'd go back 2 weeks later and say, no, I haven't viewed it. He's like, oh, that's great. Well, I guess we're done. And then I'd start again. I don't think they really maybe they didn't understand how addictive it was or they wouldn't really try to understand it from my perspective. So, I mean, I didn't really have much support on it when I did talk
to people.
Yeah,
well, it's hard to say. I mean, from my perspective right now, you know, after hearing so many of the stories, is that it sounds like what your bishops did was preferable to what a lot of them do. You know, they didn't send you to LDS social services. They didn't send you to reparative therapy. They didn't make you go through the shaming things of withholding you from taking the sacrament or participating. You were carrying the shame around. You kind of didn't get terribly shaming messages from your bishop. You're not terribly supporting either.
Right.
But it didn't sound like it led to any overt sort of problem, but it just sort of was playing out your unconscious this whole time.
Right.
Was there becoming any awareness of more awareness about being gay in general? I mean, this was kind of coming along. You said that you didn't have any interest in dating. Was there a point where you're kind of putting that all together too as...
I can remember thinking, oh, at least it's gay porn, so I'm not disrespecting women, if that makes sense. So I was like, well, at least I'm chased towards women, and essentially isn't that what's better? Is that I'll be able to have a marriage where I'm not disrespecting her because of what I did. So, I mean, to some extent, there was this feeling that, oh, I'm trying to make myself feel better. But I don't think I ever really thought about, oh, because I'm attracted to men, I'm less worthy than other people, because I never acted on it besides porn, and I knew straight people did porn too. So, I mean, I never really associated homosexuality as homosexual feelings as negative or sinful. I do know that I felt bad sometimes because my parents would often say, there was talk in my family that gay people, it's just a choice. Why can't they just change? They're hurting the family kind of thing. Especially when the Proposition 8, like whenever we'd talk about it, there was always that kind of discussion. And so there were some times when I would think, well, why can't I just change? But it never really got farther than that.
Meanwhile, how would you rate it as being a huge issue at the time, or was it just sort of some background noise?
It was still background. I mean, for me, my top priorities were always school, getting into a good college. I was very academic all throughout high school. I had my sights on college. I wanted to get into a good one and get scholarships and whatnot. So, I mean, for me, the priorities was so focused on my activities and academics that I really never thought about my sexuality or had time to give any thought to it, if that makes sense.
And what's the rest of your life, then things were going well? You said middle school was tough.
Who likes middle school? It was just like, it was just kind of, I was trying to find out who I was in terms of who are my friends kind of things, but it wasn't tough in terms of homosexuality.
And socially, things kind of went okay. You were, once again, you socialized in Mutual mostly and with your Mormon friends.
Junior and senior year, I started breaking off from my family and hanging out more with friends on weekends and such. And actually, my parents were encouraging that. In school, I was very social, but I never felt the need to call up many friends and say, hey, let's go hang out. I had a best friend that we would do soccer together and sometimes would go running together, but it wasn't ever, hey, let's go do something else. If that makes sense. On the weekends, I'd read or I'd play music or I'd go play soccer if we had a game or whatever, but it wasn't like I wanted to go play video games with a friend or go to eat somewhere with friends. That just, for me, that wasn't ever something I did.
You were content until to hang junior out at home most of the time.
Right. And even with my family, I was a little bit more solitary. I would read a lot. I would do a lot of activities that I'd do on my own.
Yeah.
That worked for me all growing up until junior, senior year when we started going to parties or would start watching movies together and things. And my parents encouraged that. They thought that was a good thing. And so they would sometimes ask, like, where are you going to go this weekend? Like, who are you going to hang out with? And because I had such a good record all growing up scholastically and friends-wise, I never had a curfew or anything. They trusted me quite well, so.
Okay.
It's pretty easygoing there.
Yeah. So you didn't give them too much grief, so they had no reason to keep it tight. Did you date at all?
My dating experiences in high school were prom and homecoming.
Two dates.
And
two dates a year.
Junior and senior year, and then the Sadie's dance when the girls would ask us.
Okay.
And that's it. I never really felt like I never wanted to. I was never driven to do it.
Uh-huh.
Plus, I was pretty busy, and so it was, I mean, a couple times I'd ask if I'd want to go on double dates, but I was like, no, I have a track meet, or I have this project coming up, or whatever. So I usually had excuses to avoid going on dates.
Huh. And what were your favorite extracurricular activities?
I loved sports. I loved being in track. I hurdled for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
And I was on the soccer team for 4 years. I also was involved in city orchestras.
What did you play?
High school orchestra.
What's your instrument?
What do I play? I play the cello.
Uh-huh.
I was also in the high school jazz band on piano.
Okay.
I was in academic clubs like the National Honor Society and stuff like that. So I was just anything that I could get my hands on, I put myself in just to be involved. And that might have been subconscious because I didn't want to deal with my problems. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I was involved in a lot of different things. And I in the end, I think I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Overall.
Well, that's not the worst way to get through high school, that's for sure.
Right. It helped me get into college.
Yeah. And so you finished up. Where did you start college? At BYU?
I didn't want to go to BYU. I was kind of sick of the Mormon scene. I'd always, all growing up, I felt like I was more playing the part rather than believing it.
Uh-huh.
I never really had any experiences before my mission where I was like, oh, this is so true. I want to be so involved. And so the thought of being at an all-Mormon high or all-Mormon college kind of scared me, in that I liked having non-Mormon friends. I liked having friends who had diverse opinions and who thought different ways. And I was pretty liberal growing up compared to most of my friends. So I really didn't want to go to BYU, but I kind of felt like, oh, I'm Mormon. I should apply there.
Uh-huh.
That's what I should do. But I was looking at schools in Oregon and California that I wanted to go to, but unfortunately the scholarships they had promised me, they had taken away right before like the acceptance deadline, so BYU was the one I could afford.
Okay.
So I came here, and it's not a bad school. I'm very happy that I came here, and it's actually given me quite a few, well, many great experiences and opened up some great opportunities for me. So I started BYU 2007. I was a freshman for a semester before I went on my mission.
Uh-huh. So how was the first year for you? Is there anything remarkable about it? Was it?
No, I was still avoiding any thought of sexuality. I didn't date much still. I went to homecoming again, and I had a really good friend that we would, a girl that we would hang out all the time, and my thought was, maybe after my mission, I'll date her.
Uh-huh.
I should say this. One of the reasons why I never dated before my mission was my brother actually had a really bad experience dating this girl before his mission, where he spent a lot of money on her and lost a lot of money. And it kind of left a bad taste in my mouth watching what he went through.
Uh-huh.
And so I had promised myself, I don't want to get in a serious relationship before my mission.
Okay.
And so that kind of took me out of any desire to even think about dating at all. And so, I mean, I left everything to what it was. At BYU, I was able to get over my porn addiction, if we want to use that language. I didn't look at porn. And so I felt I was doing great. I was like, I'm moral. I've got over this problem. I'm doing well in school. I've got great friends. And so I felt pretty good during that first semester.
Okay. And so at one point, you must have got identified with your Mormonism enough to decide to go on a mission then?
I did. I had a pretty influential religion teacher one of the projects he had us do was go do three Enos-type prayers where we had to go out into the wilderness and pray until we had nothing else to say. I remember the first two times I didn't feel anything, and I was like, this is so dumb. this is if anything, he's making me lose my testimony.
Okay.
And then on the third time, I just said, I was like, God, I just want to know if you're there. And should I go on a mission? Because this is the time my family expects it, whatever. And I felt good. It was the first time that I ever felt good praying that I can remember.
Uh-huh.
And so I was like, okay, well, then I'll go on a mission and I'll do what you want. And so I put in my papers and I got my call. And I think a lot of it still was social pressure. I knew that that's what I was supposed to do and expected to do as a young Mormon male. And that influenced a lot of my decision. But I did have that one experience when I prayed about it and I felt good.
Uh-huh.
So.
Okay.
And then I went on my mission.
So that was enough to make you go, or was it, do you think there are just the idea of being a Mormon who didn't go on a mission was...
That thought terrified me a lot. Like, what would they say? But that one experience was, I talked to my professor about it. It's like, I felt good, but what does that mean? Like, does that mean I should go? And we talked about faith and how you kind of have to jump out there. And he said that once I start my mission papers, I'll realize that that's a good thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And when I got my call, like, I mean, I got my call to the Italy Milan mission, and so it was pretty exciting just where I was going.
Yeah.
So I didn't have any second thoughts after that.
Okay. So you went, what, in the summer after your first year then?
In the spring. So I only did a semester, and then I left in March.
Oh, so you did one semester, then you took a couple months off.
Right. I went home and I worked a guy in our ward who was a dentist and went on my mission. And I had a couple of experiences with pornography again. They weren't many. And I went and I was actually, I'm pretty proud of my maturity about this. But I went to the stake president. I was like, look, this happened. And I'm okay with delaying my mission until we get this covered. And I told him the whole story since I was a kid. I was like, I want to be done with this.
Uh-huh.
He was finally, for the first time, someone took it seriously.
Yeah.
And we even considered delaying the mission, but I met with him regularly and with my bishop, and we all felt that it was a good idea to go on my mission. And so I left, and it went pretty well.
Okay, but in the meantime, did you tell him it was gay porn, or...
I mentioned it. I said that there were some instances, and he's like, well, are you gay? Is that going to be a problem in the mission? I was like, I've never really thought of being attracted to anyone in person, because I hadn't.
Uh-huh.
And again, I passed it off as kind of this curious, intentional looking at it. It wasn't like, oh, I'm gay, so I'm looking at gay porn, but I'm curious about it.
Okay. So he wasn't all over that then.
No, he kind of just left it alone.
Okay. And the mission was a positive experience for you in general?
Yeah, I loved my mission. And actually, that has defined most of what I believe testimony-wise. I remember in the missionary training center, there's a time when I realized I really don't have a testimony of anything besides I felt that one good prayer.
Uh-huh.
And so I prayed, I stopped studying the language for a while, which was a terrifying thought, but I knew that it would be better if I knew the gospel more than the language. And so I started studying the scriptures and finding out what it really meant to me. And
while
I had
at the MTC?
Some Yeah, while I was at the MTC, I didn't study the language for about a month.
Okay.
And my teachers knew it. They knew I was going through a faith crisis, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And they let me just focus on the scriptures. And I had an experience where I prayed and I felt really strongly that three things. One, that that the Book of Mormon was true. Two, that Joseph Smith was a prophet. And three, that I was supposed to be on a mission.
Uh-huh.
And so that kind of drove me into the mission and kind of helped me through anything that I was going through on the mission. I knew those three things, and that was, I would say, a defining moment in my life.
Uh-huh.
Those answers that I received.
Okay. So how was it difficult for you to be in the MTC where there's all this super intense male camaraderie, or was any of that hard for you?
I don't think it was much of a problem. I think that was one thing I was different from, I mean, I've heard stories of people who are attracted to companions or other people in the mission, but that was never an issue for me. I mean, when I, again, kind of like in high school, when I had a lot to do, I kind of just drove it out of my mind, and I never really thought about being attracted, and I just put myself into the work, and I felt that I was a pretty dedicated missionary, and that I really put everything I had into thinking about the gospel and people I was teaching. So even in the MTC with all the male missionaries, that wasn't an issue for me.
Or on your mission either?
Or on my mission, no.
Okay, so you really made it through without things being uncomfortable because of your orientation.
Right.
And so you came home after that. You came back to BYU right away?
Right. Because of a lot of the experiences with my parents about, like, I had never felt much appreciated. And then with the porn thing, when they kind of just told, kind of laid on the guilt, like, why don't you just stay at home? Like, kind of things. I didn't really want to go back home. So going back home was kind of traumatic for me when I left my mission. Because I finally felt like I was appreciated somewhere.
Okay.
And so right when I got home, I did everything I could to get out of the house. And so I went back to BYU after a month, and I had gone, I mean, I've been at BYU nonstop for about 3 years, spring, summer, every term that I could, just to have an excuse not to go back home.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I love my family. I love them. Like, I really do. And I'm growing closer to my parents, but going home is pretty stressful for me. So I would try to stay at BYU as much as I could.
Okay. Well, I can relate to that. That's how it was for me when I was your age, maybe for different
right.
reasons, but I can certainly, you know, there's a time where, for whatever reason, it's just nicer to be out on your own and away from.
Right. Right. And that was probably a lot of it
yeah.
too.
And so at some point the gay issue started to raise its head a little more. So do you want to
yeah.
go into that?
So I realized when I got home, when I started dating, because that's what you did when you were a returned missionary in the church and at BYU, was you were expected to date, you were expected to be involved in the ward. And I realized as I was dating, and I had serious girlfriends, and but it was always weird for me. I never felt comfortable, and I'd hear roommates and friends talking about how they were so excited to go on this date and how they loved being with this girl all the time. And I was like, when I seriously dated girls, it bothered me that they wanted to be with me all the time. I was like, I need my space. I don't want to be with you. I'm like, 2 dates a week is great for me. That's enough.
Yeah.
So I kind of realized that I hate using this term, that I was different from all the other guys, but I just thought that I had a very old school or traditional way of viewing dating. Because my mom actually said she felt the same way, that when I talked to her, I was like, I just don't feel like I need to spend every moment with them. And she's like, oh, that's how I dated. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, this is normal then.
Uh-huh.
It's not just me. It's just maybe how I was raised. I have a different perspective of dating. But then I started finally realizing this is not just because of how I was raised. I'm not attracted to these girls. I'm attracted to guys. And about 2 years ago, so it was about a year and a half after I got home from my mission, I finally started considering, what does this mean that I'm not attracted to women and that I'm attracted to guys? I mean, I like, whenever we'd go on group dates, I found myself listening more to the guy than to the guys than the girls. I was more interested in what they had to say, or I'd rather sit next to them in the movie or whatever it was. I realized I was not interested in the girls. I was interested in the guys. And so about 2 years ago, I was like, okay, well, I need to figure this out. What does this mean? And that was the first time that I put a label on it, that I was like, okay, well, let's define it. I'm attracted to guys. I'm gay. And that was, yeah, about a little less than 2 years ago is when I finally decided that.
Okay. But it sounds like it wasn't terribly traumatic for you, or was it, to kind of...
No, at the beginning, no. When I decided, okay, I'm gay, that was fine. But then my issue is never with being gay, because, like I said, I kind of knew my whole life that I was attracted to guys. So I just accepted that. I was like, okay, well, now I know what it is. and I moved on. But then I started, so I'm a sociology major at BYU. And so we talk about social issues all the time. And so homosexuality was one of them. And I started thinking, well, what do I do now? Like, I started realizing that it would be hard to reconcile my religion and my sexuality. And so in my major, one of the classes we took was a class on interviewing techniques. And we got to pick a project and we got to find people to interview and then do these interviews and practice our interviewing. And so I chose the reconciliation of homosexuality and religion. And so I was like, well, how did other people do it? And this would be a perfect opportunity for me to do it. And I was able to hide it very, very well because everyone in the sociology department here at BYU is pretty interested in homosexuality. It's a pretty big topic.
Okay.
And so it wasn't weird for me to be interested.
Okay.
And to want to study it. And no one really asked questions. And so we were only supposed to do two interviews, but I think I did about 8 or 9. And that sparked some of my teachers' interest. They were like, oh, this kid really wants to learn and really is interested in projects and things like that. So they never really took it as, why is he interested in homosexuality? Yeah. They took it as, he's really invested in his schooling.
Okay. Where did you find these eight subjects? Did you find?
So I went on Craigslist because it was the only thing I knew was the personals. And so I just put on there, I was like, I'm a sociology BYU student, like to interview you. Anyone who's had who was really invested in their religion and then had to reconcile their sexuality. And I got a couple of people who were really excited about sharing what they thought. The problem was, what scared me the most was most of them were, the first like four were all, oh, I left my religion to be gay. I was still very, I don't know if I'd say close-minded, but I was still very in the missionary mindset of, okay, the church is what I want to do. It's what's true in my life. And so I was like, oh, that's not what I want. So I was scared for a while. I was like, is this the only option I have?
Yeah.
But then I talked to a couple more. There was a couple who were involved with North Star who were choosing to be celibate or to marry a woman. And so I was like, okay, there's those options. And then I was really surprised when I talked to this guy in his 30s who said that his goal was to find a like-minded guy who wanted to stay in the church but have a relationship. And he's like, I understand that maybe we'll be excommunicated, but we'll still go to church and we'll at least go to the meetings and try to be as involved as we can. That was what he decided to do.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, so there's more than just the two clear-cut options of stay in the church and reject your homosexuality or be gay and reject your religion.
Yeah.
And that kind of opened up the doors. I was like, okay, this could be good. But at the same time, I was conflicted more and more. I was getting doubts more about the church rather than my homosexuality during this process. And it wasn't just because of homosexuality. I mean, it was anything that we talked about in classes. Sociology is a very anti-religious study. It's very critical of religion and any kind of non-scientific thought. And so that kind of creeped into me and just, what does religion really mean? Like, is this just a social construction? Is it real? But I kept falling back on that time in the missionary training center, the MTC, when I was like, no, I truly believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet and the Book of Mormon is true, but is the church really as infallible as it claims to be?
Yeah.
Can they really stake a claim to this truth? And really, what do they really know what's going on with homosexuality? And do they really know, are they really getting revelation on it? Or are they just basing it off of this random scripture that vaguely mentions it? And is that appropriate for our time, kind of thing? So these questions started raising in my mind after talking to these guys, and that's when I started seriously considering my options. And that was the most difficult time, I would say. It was more of a crisis of faith rather than a crisis of, oh my gosh, I'm gay, if that makes sense. And I had a pretty hard time with it. I decided to go on a study abroad to Italy to kind of get away from everyone, and search out what it meant for me. And it was there that, so I read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, yeah. And that kind of opened up a lot of what God, who God is, for me, more of a loving kind of person and what Christianity means. And I kind of started seeing that Christianity didn't, and Mormonism didn't have to be so, I'll say this, I was separating culture from doctrine, if that makes sense. Yeah. I was starting to see what was more culturally preached rather than doctrinally preached. And that helped a lot for me. And I was able to finally be, I was able to sit down and be like, okay, I'm gay and I'm Mormon and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm fine and it's going to work out. I don't know. I started realizing I don't know what's in the future, but this will be okay. And I prayed a lot while I was there. And I mean, I think like a lot of people in my position, I had one or two prayers where I was like, you know what? It would be easier if I wasn't gay. God, if this is possible, take it away. But then I was like, but he's not going to. I realized that. And so I was like, okay, God, help me figure out what to do with it. And I got this kind of feeling where I was like, you're okay that you're gay. And I actually, and it was more like, this is part of you and you need to embrace it. It was, stop trying to fight this, if that makes sense.
Okay. Did you see that as an answer to your prayer? I mean, did this come as kind of in a sense that matched your experiences of spiritual confirmations in the past?
Right. It was pretty much the same feelings that I got when I felt I would receive revelation about the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith. So I attribute it to the same source that God was telling me that this is part of who I am. And it, even in the last couple months, I've been making, I got involved in the North Star group and I asked them, I was like, do you guys feel the same way? Cause this is what I felt. And I actually got some pretty negative feedback that, a lot of the people on that were like, no, this is not our identity. This is a mortal trial. Just pretty comments like that. And so I was like, oh, I don't understand. Like, this is really how I feel. And so I went back to praying and I was like, God, tell me what is this really how it is? And I got an even stronger confirmation that I am gay and that's part of who I am. And, interestingly, the more I studied it, I was like, okay, well, let's go to the proclamation to the world about the family. What does it say about gender and sexuality? It doesn't talk much about sexuality, but when it was talking about the gender, it talked about how this is an eternal identity, right? And so, I went and I prayed. I was like, God, is my sexuality eternal? Like, is this really part of who I am? And I felt again, just like I did when I prayed about the Book of Mormon, that I am gay as an eternal being. This isn't something that, is only going to be here for this time. And once I die and am resurrected, I'll suddenly be straight. I don't believe that that's how it is. I believe that I am gay and that's part of who I am and I will always be gay. And that was probably one of the moments when I finally had the most peace with it.
Uh-huh.
Was when I realized that, no, God is, this is who I am.
Yeah.
I'm not a mistake. I don't have a disease. I don't have this temporary condition that I just have to make it through and then everything will be okay. But this is who I am and I'm okay with that. And God's okay with that. And that, and that was more important to me than anything that people were saying.
Yeah. Would you be willing to tell me in general what personal revelation feels like? What is the experience for you? Not just in all of them. You say that they're all the same, both your confirmation of the Book of Mormon, the confirmation of your sexual orientation, all that. But what's the experience? Right. What is the spiritual experience? What is the experience for you?
In terms of these events, I mean, I would say there's few times when God's really given me direction, and these are the few times. The only other times was when I chose my major. I felt that God helped me choose that. And in each of these instances, it was a time when I was very anxious and very confused and very conflicted.
Uh-huh.
And I had all the reason to go either way. Like, say, with knowing whether the church was true and whether the Book of Mormon was true. I told God I was like, if this is not true, I'm willing to go home. I'm willing to suffer the social consequences of going home.
Yeah.
Like, and, cause I don't want to sit here and tell people that this is great and wonderful if it's not. And so please tell me. I was like, whichever way it is, I will do it. And so it reminded me of the Moronite classic scripture of, if you have real intent, God will give you an answer. And I felt that at each of these times I'd gotten to this really conflicted stance where I was like, you know what? I'd rather suffer any consequences than be in this conflicted state because it's driving me insane.
Yeah.
And so I would pray about it, and then I would just get this feeling where all of that conflict and all of that trouble and all of that worry would leave. And I would just, and the side that I thought about, like, it would just, like, the idea would come into my mind, the Book of Mormon is true, and I just felt peaceful. It was just, everything's going to be all right. There's not going to be any problems. Like, go with this.
Uh-huh.
And so when I, in specific regard to, is this an eternal identity kind of thing? I was praying, I was like, God, if this is not an eternal identity, I'm fine. I will work on being celibate. I will, maybe even try to find a wife. I don't care. I'm willing to do whatever it takes to get this conflict out of my mind. And if it is an eternal identity, I'm willing to do what you want me to do with it.
Uh-huh.
In whichever direction, just take away this conflict. And so I prayed and I prayed and I prayed, and finally I got to this point where all the worry went away. And I thought, I was like, okay, is this an eternal identity? And I felt, yes, I felt this good, peaceful feeling. And I need to go with that. That is what it is. And since then I haven't worried about it. It's never been an issue. I've lost that conflict that was plaguing my senses. If I could say that.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the experience that I had.
Okay. And that must have been, was a little bit surprising.
Yeah, I mean, because when I had mentioned it to the North Star groups, one of the members actually told me that I was being a heretic, that I was preaching false doctrine, and he sent me a link to this evergreen article spoken by, I think it was Bruce C. Hafen. He's a member of the presidency of the 70, I think. And anyways, he very clearly says that sexuality will change and that this is not an eternal thing. And I was very surprised at how forthcoming he was with his beliefs on what homosexuality was. And so I read over the talk and I was trying to be open-minded and like, oh, okay, well, finally here's something that one of the general authorities has said something very clear cut about, because most of what I had read from the church was very vague. Oh, we love people who are gay, but we want you to be in the church. And that's really all I felt was said about it. And so
Yeah. This
was the first time that I actually got, oh, wow, this is something that they're saying, that homosexuality is really just a temporal thing and you're not supposed to act on it. And so I was interested to see where he was getting his information from. And he had started quoting talks from Elder Oaks and some research studies by BYU professors. And so, I mean, I was surprised that I had never seen these studies before, because I'm actively involved in that academic research of homosexuality and I'm trying to read up as much as I can.
Yeah.
And so I was reading these studies that he was citing, and they were all BYU, and so, I mean, there's extreme bias on it. And I was reading the people who were citing the studies, and they were all showing how this study was flawed and how you can't come to these conclusions. He was saying that the studies were mainly about reparative therapy works and that you can change your sexuality even in this life. And most of the responding reports were, this was a terrible study and really makes no conclusions.
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh, that's troublesome that he's making such harsh remarks about homosexuality on this, using scientific research that isn't even accepted scientifically. And then I looked up the quotes he was using from Elder Oaks, and I felt that most of the comments the conclusions he was drawing were kind of non sequitur and didn't really follow. They didn't make sense. you couldn't really draw those conclusions. And so I pointed those out to this kid who was using this this talk as pretty much his doctrine on what he felt about homosexuality. And I told him, I was like, I don't feel like this is well done. I don't feel like it's coming from God. I feel like it's mostly his feelings, and kind of he's just embellishing on the cultural beliefs of his time. I didn't feel like it was really resonating with what I had felt. And so that was interesting. And so
didn't
that
go
was kind
too
of
well with him though.
Right. And so that was when I took it again to the Lord. I was like, look, I just read this. What does it mean? And that's when I got my, no, this is something eternal. And going back and reading Elder Oakes's talk, I think you could pull just as well my conclusions from that talk as much as Elder Hafen pulled that this is not eternal identity. So I don't feel that anything that the 12 had said could go against what I was personally feeling. I don't feel that I'm in contradiction with any core doctrine.
When was this Hafen speech from?
It was in 2007, I'm pretty sure. 2009 or 2007.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, if anyone wants to look it up, it's on the Evergreen website. He sent me a link to it. And what also bothered me was that it wasn't like he was on official it wasn't an official representation of the church either. It wasn't like the church assigned him to speak there.
It was Bruce Hafen speaking for Evergreen then.
Right, right. Okay. And so it was kind of, I was like, well, can you really count this as something as official church doctrine? And there were so many questions that was raised. I was like, no, I don't feel like this is the official church's position, especially going back to what the 12 said and the church website. I feel that what God told me actually falls in line with what the 12 have said. And so I'm pretty comfortable with, I don't feel that you could say that when people tell me that what I've experienced is actually not from God, I feel differently.
Yeah. What if some general authority, such as Boyd K. Packer, said something that you just was different than what your answer was? Where would you put that?
Right. And that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think part of my studies have led me to believe that I need to be truer to God over truer to the church. I don't feel like there has been sufficient enough understanding by the church to be able to make sweeping statements on homosexuality. And so if they came out with a statement and just said homosexuality is not an eternal identity, I think I'd have qualms with that. And unless they were able to give me substantial evidence and say that they had prayed and gotten this revelation, I think I would have problems with that and still believe what God has told me. And if they had been able to give, like, we have knelt in prayer and we all got the same feeling that this is not how it is, then I would retake it to the Lord and I'd say, okay, God, this happened. The prophet said this in contradiction to what I felt about what you said. So tell me what's going on. Is this who I am or is this not? And I'd have to go with what it said then. I won't try to say what God will tell me in the future, but if they came out so firmly, I'd just take it back to the Lord and see what he said. And if I feel the same thing confirming that this is an eternal identity, I'd have to go with it.
Okay. So right now your perspective about words of the church leaders is that it's possible that there's a distinction when they really say this is a revelation, you know, like when the blacks got the priesthood, they really said this was a revelation.
Right.
But then they also give lots of speeches where there's might be possibly saying things that aren't necessarily revelations there.
Right. And I think, I mean, there have been many instances where the 12 have rescinded statements or changed what they've said in the past because it really doesn't fit with what was then revealed in the further on. And so whenever in general conference or in the ensign, they come out with a statement, but it's just one apostle or one general authority saying it. I take it for what it's worth. I go and I pray about it to make sure that this is true for me as well. But it's harder to take it substantially unless it's one of these uniform decisions that the church comes out with and says, we've all prayed about this and this is what it is.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Okay. And, but even in the end, you feel like your personal revelation is really critical to accepting really anything.
Yeah.
Because that's what brought you to the, your testimony in the first place.
Right. I mean, the LDS religion was founded upon personal revelation. And I believe in that very strongly, that the Lord will tell me which way to go. And I'm not going to, like, I feel that personal revelation in some sense can trump the church revelation, in very real ways. I mean, I've talked to people who are gay and who were suicidal, and God told them to leave the church. To me, that makes a lot of sense. Like, I think God would rather someone leave the church than stay in the church and then commit suicide,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Right. And so I feel in very real ways there are certain situations when God is going to tell people to do things that are not completely in line with what the church teaches or believes for very real and understandable reasons. And so I would, if God told me very really that something that I believe is in direct contract with what the church professed, but he has repeatedly helped me understand that what I'm feeling is true, then I'm going to go with that feeling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to me, that makes sense because, once again, if you're told to believe in the church because of your personal revelation, what exactly was your personal revelation? Well, was it the Book of Mormon was true, or did the personal revelation you received tell you to believe everything that comes out of the mouth of an apostle?
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
So we can't, I mean, if you're going to approach it logically, which makes sense to do, then we have to really say, well, what was the question and what was answered? And does this mean I have to set aside all questions? Because now that I've got one answer, from now on, all I have to do is listen to the prophets because I don't have to get answers anymore.
Right. And
that might work for
Joseph
some
Smith
people.
Didn't do, yeah. Right. For me, like, studying, because one of the things that I asked was Joseph Smith a prophet? And I feel very strongly that he was. And so I take much to looking at Joseph Smith's life. And I mean, setting up the church, it wasn't, he didn't translate the Book of Mormon and then base his whole religion on the Book of Mormon. He kept on asking questions over and over again to make sure that what he was doing was right. And I think that's a smart way to go about it, is he didn't just ask one question and then live his life basing his life on that one question.
Yeah.
I feel that we need to repeatedly be finding out what our direction is. So that's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, I mean, this is the same perspective I had as a Mormon, was that there were a lot of questions and the personal revelation was available, and that we need guides in our life for difficult questions, because the church, even though they claim to have a lot of answers, does the church really claim to have all the answers? I mean, I hope they don't, because I don't think they have all the answers. But I don't really think they claim to have all the answers.
Right.
And the people who think they have all the answers are the ones who find themselves disappointed when something doesn't quite come out right, you know?
Right.
So I think that each individual, you know, that's a beautiful thing about Mormonism. Each individual has the right to their own personal answers. It gets hard when it, you know, on the surface seems to be against what the general body of Mormons believe, which is the predicament most gay people are in. But you have to, you can't fault a gay person who goes and gets an answer, and you can't fault him for believing in the answer, especially if it's consistent with the same way he got answers on other important questions about his religion.
Right. And I've always thought that was funny when I'd hear elders in the mission say, when people were say, oh, you don't know that, like in speaking about the church, and they'd say, no, I received personal revelation about it. And then when I say, oh, I believe that being gay is an eternal identity, and they say, you don't know that, and I say, oh, I got personal revelation about it, suddenly that's doubted.
Yeah.
Whereas no one doubts it when a missionary says, oh, but I prayed about it and got an answer. why can't I pray about being gay and getting hands? So that's always bothered me when I talk to people about this. They're like, well, that you don't know that. Well, maybe I do. So that's been one of the frustrations with just the general culture of the church, is that they believe in personal revelation only up to a point.
Yeah.
So, and that's been kind of frustrating when I've been trying to like explain why I do things or why I'm living this way, because they really don't have that complete belief in personal revelation as a whole, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I do. I mean, and it surprises me that more people don't, you know, arrive sooner to the conclusion that you arrived at. So,
right.
But I kind of personally, I like to promote that idea that you have every right of asking, because I think that's exactly what James said.
Right.
James, you know, the scripture that inspired Joseph Smith to ask in the first place. That's what it's telling us we can and should do. So,
right.
Well, you know, thanks for sharing that.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see the podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation today at gaymormonstories.org. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Nabby Parkinson Folk and Ricky Parkinson.
That thou hast shown, pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own. Savior, may I learn to love thee. Thy son.